They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
You are free to do as we tell you. You are free to do as we tell you.
They own you.
I was mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
From XPR, Expat Progressive Radio, it's time for the Bills Show. And now, here are the Bills.
Demonstrate to them our skill, albeit they possess the might.
And welcome to the Bills Show, and coming to you from Harvard University. That's right, the desk that I am actually recording this podcast from is really friggin' old. Within sight of the Harvard, the John F. Kennedy School of Government, this is the Bills Show on the road here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, well, it's been a fantastic trip back. Managed to go to New York City, and we've actually went on a tour of the White House, ladies and gentlemen. So it was very, very nice. I'm going to have a little bit of a comment about how America has changed the last 2 years since I've been here. In politics, now, as you know, the other Bill is not with us today. I'm doing this one alone. In politics, there's been a bit of a fuss, a little mea culpa happening there in Washington, where I was just last week. And it came out of the Sunday morning talk shows, and it started something like this.
Has this been the worst year of your presidency?
I got to tell you, Julie, that's not how I think about it. I look at this past year. There are areas where there obviously have been some frustrations, where I wish Congress had moved more aggressively. If you're measuring this by polls, my polls have gone up and down a lot through the course of my career.
How about those polls that the president claims not to be too worried about? Here's the latest CNN ORC poll showing his approval rating 41%. It matches the all-time low for him in our polling. So was this the worst year of his presidency, and where does the administration go from here? Well, let's bring in our panel, CNN political commentator and Republican strategist Kevin Madden, Washington bureau chief for USA Today, Susan Page, and co-host of CNN's Crossfire, Van Jones. So the president was asked what his biggest mistake was this year, and this is what he said.
It happened in the first month, first 6 weeks, in a way that was at all acceptable. And since I'm in charge, obviously we screwed it up.
He's talking about Obamacare there. Was Obamacare the biggest mistake of the year, you think?
What a year when the questions at the end of the year are, is this your worst year ever? What was your biggest mistake? Will you ever get improve in the polls because you're in such a terrible state? I mean, can you imagine? Yes, Obamacare, his biggest legislative achievement, now his biggest problem, and the one that has defined him in a way that's very damaging, that likens him, really, I think, in a lot of ways, to President George W. Bush and the Iraq War.
Yes, the funniest thing that I have heard all year. Yes, the rollout of Obamacare is not only his Katrina, it's his Iraq War. Are you on drugs? Is America on drugs? Let me tell you something. This is just our podcast. This is my podcast. Bill is not here. He's not here to heap it on Obama. But listen, let's just calm down a minute. There are two reasons why Obama has not had a terrible year, and I'll give you those two. And it's about time that everybody start laying off the guy. First of all, yes, Obamacare hasn't been fantastic in the rollout, but of course people are enrolling more and more. It's going to get better. And in the next 6 months, we're going to forget all this computer problems. It's going to be over with and people are going to have insurance. Just like they have in Massachusetts, where you have literally 97% of the people in this state where I'm talking to you from, where they have a thing called RomneyCare, strangely enough, that is just like Obamacare, and 97% of the people are insured. And it has the best health coverage of any state in the union. And that's going to happen in the next 6 months, guys. Obamacare is not the equivalent of the Iraq War. You're mad. And if ever you wanted to see the truth of the matter that Obama has to deal not only with a hostile Congress, but also the hostile press. There are a lot of things that Bill and I take Barack Obama to task with, and I'm not going to go into them now. I have on previous shows. I've been very disappointed a lot of the time. Lighten up on this guy, because there are two other reasons why you should rejoice and be very, very happy that Barack Obama is president of the United States. One of them's Iran, and one of them is Syria. These are two wars you can bet your bottom dollar, ladies and gentlemen. If Mitt Romney was president of the United States right now, we would be in Syria and we would be in Iran by now. We are not in those two wars. We have opened up diplomatic relations with Iran for the first time that I can remember. And that is because we have a president that actually sits down and talks rather than whose first option is to sacrifice American lives on the ground. So in my first little issue here, I have been listening to this nonsense for the past week. Okay? You can thank your lucky stars for many, many reasons, and one of them is that Barack Obama is president of the United States. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about who does not want this Iranian diplomacy to go ahead, and we're going to talk about that after this message.
It's these bailouts that represent the abandonment of capitalism.
Blowing the tops off mountains!
If you're out of a job, I guess you're a bum. They don't think that maybe it wasn't their fault. Maybe it was your fault, Orrin Hatch.
In healthcare, the lie that we should just allow the industry to run in a free market mode, the invisible hand of the market's going to take care of itself, nothing is farther from the truth.
This is Obama's my pet goat moment.
There's a Bush up for that.
Isn't this the end of democracy as we know it? If 51 senators can pass something against the will of the majority, 49.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
Off the top, you may recall, if you've seen our program last week, we had a little spirited fun with Fox News personality Megyn Kelly. We're really scamps. And her response to a columnist's suggestion that maybe Santa Claus could be a color other than white.
For all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white. Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it.
See? Like most debates, it started by giving you the definitive answer first. Now, unfortunately for Ms. Kelly, for Fox, her program is televised. And people who saw this segment or read about it expressed an opinion that what she said was wrong and inexplicably defensive and oddly definitive for a discussion of a fictional character and up. People thought it was like really up. That was actually The Economist's take on it. But on Friday, Ms. Kelly took to the airwaves to clear things up.
In kicking off the lighthearted segment, I offered a tongue-in-cheek message for any kids watching, saying that Santa, who I joked is a real person whose race is identifiable, is white. An offhand jest I made has now become a national firestorm. Humor is a part of what we try to bring to this show, but sometimes that is lost on the humorless. And Fox News and yours truly are big targets for many people.
I guess we all owe you an apology. What appeared to me to be another example of a Fox News segment expressing anger and victimization over the loss of absolute power and reframing that as persecution of real America by minorities, freeloaders, and socialists. That's trademarked, by the way. What I thought was that was actually a jest, a jape, a bit of voice crackery. Sure, if we look at the original clip again, in that context, we'll all be able to find it as humorous as it was sincerely intended to be.
For all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white. Yeah. Jesus was a white man, too. Just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change.
Oh, I get it.
Yes, it's Megyn Kelly proving once again that she's funny in any time zone. And don't forget, Santa Claus, kids, was a white guy. And Jesus was born in the Middle East, but unlike everybody else in the Middle East, he kind of looks like a German guy. Good fun. Good times, Megyn Kelly. Now, people like Megyn Kelly, this is, try this for a segue, ladies and gentlemen. People like Megyn Kelly over at Fox News are very upset recently because Obama, who spent the last week apologizing for evidently all the shit he's done, like trying to bring health care to America, also did this.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. Breaking overnight, an historic deal.
We have a real opportunity to achieve a comprehensive, peaceful settlement.
The international community and America's longtime enemy forge a late-night landmark pact to freeze Iran's nuclear program.
Yes, kids, that's right. We're not going to war with Iran. What a lovely thing. And, you know, evidently there are, however, there are so many people that are really upset because, you know, they were planning on this war a long time. Planning. In fact, the Israel lobby has been kind of busy recently, and this came out despite the fact that, you know, I am waiting for Obama to apologize for not getting us involved in another destructive war or a nuclear confrontation with Iran, because that's one of the terrible things he's done. Iran sanctions. Evidently, the possibility exists, or has existed in the last week, that a couple of our good friends in the Senate may try to completely torpedo the landmark negotiations that have been going on between Mr. Personality, John Kerry, and Iran, that have been successful, which, by the way, I believe is a great success, but not according to Bob Menendez and Mark Kirk. Senator Bob Menendez and Mark Cook are threatening to push the U.S. and United States towards war with Iran, circulating and planning to introduce a sanctions bill, despite warnings that it could derail the nuclear negotiations at a delicate moment. International observers are, this is, by the way, off the Washington Post. International observers and both parties to the negotiations have repeatedly pleaded with Congress to allow the talks to unfold, warnings that Kirk and Menendez, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, appear intent on ignoring. Senator Charles Schumer is also part of the effort through much of the final though much of the final decision rests on Menendez. The White House doesn't want a bill, that's true. Menendez and Kirk are working on it and trying to build a list of co-sponsors. What the hell is going on? These guys are Democrats and Republicans who are obviously being put up. Ladies and gentlemen, they're being put up by a lot of people who are absolutely sold on the idea that America must go to war. Defenders of the Menendez move say it is intended to strengthen the White House hand. So people are defending it, saying that they're good cop, bad copping him. That's not how we at the Bill Show, at least this member of the Bill Show, view it. If you look very, very hard at those people that have been in control, or people who have been controlling the Israel lobby in the Senate. And by the way, here's an idea. Just because I'm criticizing the Israel lobby in the Senate and the Congress does not mean I'm anti-Semitic or I believe that Israel hasn't got a right to exist. They do. But you know what Israel hasn't got the right to do? The Israel has not got the right to manipulate America to be its pawn in a move against Iran. I understand why Israel's upset about the possibility of nukes being built in Iran. I understand that. Totally. But the simple fact of the matter is certain people want to have a war happen with Iran. We cannot afford another war. And I think Kerry understands that. Obama understands that. That's why we're not in Syria. And that's why we're not in Iran. Menendez and these senators have a blatant history of siding with guys like the one I'm going to give you right now. This is a guy named Sheldon Adelson. He's been a popular member of our show. He's also one of the great big financiers of Bibi Netanyahu. Let me have a listen to the way they want to handle the Iran situation.
I think it's the worst negotiating ploy tactic anybody could imagine.
Right, so you would support negotiations with Iran currently so long as they first seized all enrichment of uranium?
No. What do you mean support negotiation? What are we going to negotiate about? What I would say is, listen, you see that desert out there? I want to show you something. You pick up your cell phone, even at traveling rates. You pick up your cell phone, and what are they called?
Roaming charges.
Roaming charges. You pick up your cell phone, and you call somewhere in Nebraska, and you say, okay, let it go. So there's an atomic weapon goes over ballistic missiles in middle of the desert that doesn't hurt a soul. Maybe a couple of rattlesnakes and scorpions or whatever. And then you say, see, the next one is in the middle of Tehran.
Now that's the kind of diplomacy you want, right? Do what we say, or we will incinerate your major city. And that's it. Where does the Israel lobby feel that it can get off making such wild threats in the Middle East? Well, they get that way because they believe they control American foreign policy. And to a certain extent, they're right. Has anyone heard of APEC? APEC is the right-wing lobby which largely controls American foreign policy towards Israel. And it distributes a lot of money. Yes, a lot of money, both in the Senate and the Congress. This is from the Daily Kos. APEC channels millions of dollars in campaign contributions to campaigns for federal office through a network of political action committees established throughout the United States by members of APEC's National Board of Directors. These directors boast that for every dollar that enters congressional campaigns through the PACs, they can steer at least one additional dollar to a friendly congressional incumbent. In closed meeting for APEC members only, APEC directors have taken full partial credit for the defeats of two former chairmen of Senate Foreign Relations Committees, Republican Charles Percy of Illinois, and Democrat J. William Fulbright of Arkansas. The lobby is exactly how APEC is referred to by members of Congress, one of whom recently remarked to a foreign visitor that APEC visits to his office are the most unpleasant moments on his congressional schedule. Here are some of the APEC campaign contributions to congressmen. Highest goes first. Joseph Lieberman, over $1 million. But when we went through the congressmen and senators that are on the list of people who receive large amounts of money from APEC. What a surprise! Menendez, $219,135. How about Mr. Kirk? Let's have a look at that. Mr. Kirk, you wouldn't happen to be on that list as well, would you?
Of course! Heading the list of top House recipients funded by APEC is Mark Kirk at $458,979, close to $500,000. You get to think of who's pulling whose strings here. Not only that, if you look at the previous experience Mr. Kirk has had in his campaigning for a war with Iran, listen to this. This is from 1996, in which he is talking about the use of a oil embargo against Iran. When he was told that this was damaging to the citizens of Iran, to the children of Iran, to the just average citizens of Iran, this was his response in 1996.
Foreign diplomats and Americans who are here.
Senator Ron Majors, I'm always, once we get into sanctions and taking those kinds of actions, the argument immediately becomes, are you really going after the government of the country, or are you taking food out of the mouths of the citizens?
It's okay to take the food out of the mouths of the citizens from a government that's plotting an attack directly on American soil.
Can the United States unilaterally do this?
Absolutely. And Undersecretary...
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice. But the price, we think the price is worth it.
That was former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright from 1996. Oh, by the way, 1996. That means we have been kicking the crap out of Iran for a very, very long time. Not to mention the fact that in 1952, we overthrew duly elected government in Iran, replaced them with the Shah, and train their secret police to torture their people for the next 30 years. I can't understand why they hate us. It must be because of our freedom. What's disturbing about the current push for war is it's the same guys, ladies and gentlemen, the same guys. And for the first time in a long time, we have an American president that's not necessarily just reading from the playbook. For that, we need to give Barack Obama kudos. And also be very, very aware where Mr. Menendez and Mr. Kirk get their money and their marching orders. We'll be right back.
Let's take a look at how people, why they disapprove. You have the 41% approve, 40% disapprove because they think President Obama is too liberal, 12% disapprove because they think he's not liberal enough. So one in five of those who disapprove think that President Obama is too conservative.
It's interesting, these numbers, and if you take a look at how the president's doing now, how is the approval of the president's job as president now? 41%, as you point out, in November was 41%, but in May, you know, he was at 53%, so he's really gone down over the course of this year. When you compare him to other presidents, two-term presidents, at a similar moment in their presidency, how's he doing?
Well, he's exactly where George W. Bush was at this point in his presidency. Bush in December 2005 was at 41%, which is also where Obama is right now. President Clinton in December 97 was at 56% approval. Reagan in December 1985, 63%. As a lot of political analysts will tell you, Wolf, once you go below 50%, it is very difficult to get back up there. George W. Bush went down, and then he never got back above 50% approval. President Obama's aides obviously hoping that he can turn this around and will be able to get up from 41% to above 50%.
Now it's time for the Bill Show's Message from America this holidays.
We're, of course, broadcasting this abbreviated Bill Show from overseas. And I'm sitting in a hotel room. Now I'm in Provincetown, Cape Cod. And, well, it's been 2 years since I came home to see the relatives of the good old U.S. of A. And besides the ritual of actually sucking my knees through my nostrils for 21 hours in cattle class, I have always enjoyed and valued my trips back to the Boston area. I grew up here and still have fine memories of my early days working as an actor in regional theater and attending the odd course at Northeastern University, where so many of my lifelong friendships were formed during the 70s and 80s. Not only do I enjoy coming back here, but I tend to actually get a New England accent simply by being in the vicinity for more than 2 weeks. My family are far more conservative than me politically, though my dad is probably one of the few diehard Obama fans amongst the dentists and hedge fund managers that now populate Cape Cod. My sister and her family are lovely folks with whom I do not discuss politics, and this is a very difficult since you've become somewhat of a diehard political junkie and maybe a bit of a socialist lefty after living in Australia. But they're tolerant of me and I of them, and we have a love that transcends politics, tolerance of our political differences. When it comes to the podcast, which I started over 2 years ago with my dear friend Bill in Australia, I wanted it to be a way for an ex-actor with a loud mouth and an attitude to articulate what he was feeling about what I considered to be the change in my homeland since I had left here some 20 years ago. Bill felt the same way, and we had time to spare and a microphone. The rest is history. Since we started our little podcast, we've received over 60,000 hits from all over the world, and we've been featured on national shows in the U.S., such as Best of the Left. Now, we still have not made a dime off this venture. It is now what it has always been, a way for us to share what we're thinking with people who might be interested. The podcast, however, remains a secret to most of my family. Now, this being the start of a new year, I feel impelled to reflect back on my observations of America at the end of 2014. Let me frame this in the form of a story. Ready, kids? Okay. My wife and I last week ventured back to Harvard University, where I recorded half of this broadcast. I never attended Harvard, but loved the history of Cambridge and Harvard in particular. But I must say the university itself lost much of its luster when it graduated George W. Bush and Henry Kissinger. Still, it's a great place for bookstores, really good bookstores. If you love books, go to Harvard Bookstore or the Harvard Coop across from Harvard Yard. You won't be disappointed. Another great thing is the Brattle Street Theater. There's a small little movie house that they have yet to tear down in favor of yet another Starbucks, TGIFs, or God knows what satanic franchise outlet that you can see in every fucking suburb from sea to shining sea nowadays. The great thing about the Brattle is that they show nothing but classics. This New Year's they're going to be showing the Marx Brothers Marathon. Bloody brilliant. Well, that night, we happened to stumble by when they were showing one of my all-time favorite movies, and don't laugh, it's Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed, and It's a Wonderful Life. Now, there are two things I know about It's a Wonderful Life. If you don't cry at the end of the movie, there's something elementally wrong with you. You're a reptile. You are definitely a child of Mordor or the bastard son of Mitt Romney and Donald Rumsfeld. The ending is a redemption from one of the darkest movie moments in American history. Stewart realizing the value of his life and its meaning to the many lives that would have been utterly destroyed without him. The other thing I know, and I know about the movie because I first saw it when I was 12, is that it is a highly political film. When George Bailey sees the result of Bedford Falls adopting the moral compass of miserly old Potter in his credo of dividing humanity into the rich, him, and the suckers, everybody else, you see the fallout. The friends of George have lost their families to poverty, living in the slums of Potter's Field. George's somewhat flirty friend from school, Violet, has become a low-class hooker. His former boss is a derelict, and the population of Pottersville gain amusement from watching his ritual humiliation. Bert the cop, a kindly policeman in Bedford Falls, is now a violent thug who shoots first and answers questions later.
George's wife is destined to spend her life closing up the Pottersville's crumbling library. The main street is a gallery for desperate hucksters in neon. The community has gone into atrophy. Pottersville is a cruel and cynical place. It is no mistake that Frank Capra shows us this world as a result of Potter's cruel, ruthless, capitalistic credo put into practice. After stumbling out of the theater and wiping a tear from my eye, which I always do, I started to put together the podcast late at night in our accommodation at Harvard. While in the afterglow of Capra's story, I played one of the cuts that I had set aside for the final show of the year. It was a tape of Tea Party sweetheart Ron Paul advocating that in the last week before Christmas, during the aftermath of one of the worst financial disasters in U.S. history, that we cut off unemployment benefits to families across the United States. This was his rationale.
I do support unemployment benefits for the 26 weeks that they're paid for. If you extend it beyond that, you do a disservice to these workers. There was a study that came out a few months ago, and it said if you have a worker that's been unemployed for 4 weeks and on unemployment insurance and one that's on 99 weeks, which would you hire? Every employer, nearly 100%, said they will always hire the person who's been out of work 4 weeks. When you allow people to be on unemployment insurance for 99 weeks, you're causing them to become part of this perpetual unemployed group in our economy.
3 weeks later, Stuart Varney spoke out against raising the minimum wage higher than a paltry $7.50 an hour.
I know you're going to give us the emotional side of the story. People need $15 per hour to live on. They're starving without it. Okay, I got that. I want to ask you about the economics of it. Do you think that someone fresh out of high school, they didn't get a diploma, they don't really have any basic skills, do you think that they deserve $15?
So now feeding unemployed families at Christmas is doing them a disservice? After cutting food stamps? We're telling 29-year-old people supporting kids that they deserve to be making a full-time salary that puts them below the poverty line? Let's make no mistake, even the die-hard Republican Jimmy Stewart would retch at the bastardry of today's Republican Party and conservative media. They are Mr. Potter incarnate. They have changed America into a much crueler place in the last 20 years, to the point that a man can advocate defunding families at Christmas and claim to be doing it for their own benefit. That a man can also get away with calling himself a populist while doing that is simply crazy. This simple humanist message made by Frank Capra held much impact for me this year. I hope that all of us next year will try to be a little more George Bailey and a little less Potter. Let's listen to the better angels of our nature in the coming year and reserve the trash bin for those who would allow us to be more callous to our fellow Americans. We can view Capra's classic as a corny Hollywood chestnut, or take from it its real message. We become a better society when we're kinder to each other. The Bill Show wishes you the best of the holidays. It's now well past New Year's, but we wish you a happy New Year. We want to thank all our regular listeners and hope to hear from all of you in the new year. I'll be with Bill coming up on another show as we'll comment more on politics. I'd like to leave you tonight with a little more fun from the good folks at Bedford Falls. Good night from Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, I left right in the middle of it. As soon as I got Mary's telegram. Good idea, Ernie. A toast to my big brother George, the richest man in town.
Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right. Attaboy, Clarence.